The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Alex Krotowski. On today's program, we're out and about at The Guardian's Activate Summit. Activate is a day of ideas, inspiration, and insight into technology and the web as it reshapes our world. On today's program, we'll hear from CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, the UK's digital champion, Martha Lane Fox, and her US equivalent, Beth Novick, and the open data proponent, Nigel Shadbolt. Yes, it's the good and the great in charge of the next chapter in the story of the web on this week's Tech Weekly. We found a quiet corner in King's Place. The main event at Activate 2010 was the conversation between The Guardian's editor, Alan Rusbridger, and the worldwide CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt. Here's Eric Schmidt talking about Google's ongoing search for trust from its consumers.
Well, first of all, I would say to all of you that I believe that this is an evergreen issue for Google. I believe that every month of every year, this will be the number one question from properly researching journalists, from governments, and so forth and so on. Not only is it the right question, but I think it's a question that won't be resolved by anything I say or do right now. And the fundamental reason is because there's a natural distrust, if you will, of large institutions which are collecting a lot of data. Now, it will shock you to discover that there are other large institutions that are collecting large amounts of data. For example, the telephone companies all know exactly where you are. How do they know that? Because they run your phone. Okay. Are you shocked by that? Does it bother you? Are you demonstrating in the streets? Right? But the fact of the matter is that information is constrained or is well known. So my point here is that the collection of this kind of information is a natural byproduct of the way these networks work. It's very, very important that we understand what's being collected and why. The Wi-Fi case that you mentioned was an error on our part, and we fessed up. We said, look, we made an error. But for example, we are subject to what is called the European Data Privacy Initiative, which we're actually fine with, which basically says you can keep this amount of information for this period of time, then you have to forget it. And I can go through the details. But I think there'll be more of those kinds of rules, and I think they're perfectly fine. These are not decisions I think that Google should make. I think they're fundamentally societal. This trade-off between privacy and police action and so forth, that's sort of above my pay grade. And I think it will, as I said, it will change by, it will also differ by country. We, Google, try to think of it in terms of its impact on the end user. And as long as we stay on the right side of that privacy line, in our view, and as long as the users have a choice of whether they continue to use Google or not, we're probably fine. If we violated each of your privacy in some fundamental way right now, not only would you leave us, but you would leave us forever. That's how quick you would move from us. So the real disincentive for us of violating people's trust is we'll lose our customers, and our customers are everything.
So the only company that is in the same sort of realm of controversy in this, because you're both at the forefront of this debate, is Facebook. Mm-hmm. So what's different between you and Facebook in the way that you've approached these issues and the problems?
Well, we sent a lot of our people over there. So
what did you do wrong with Buzz, or what were your reflections on Buzz?
We've made it. To be clear, the company is not perfect. We've made some mistakes. Buzz is an example where when we introduced it, it made it appear, because of the user interface that we did, that we were releasing to your friends and people who you thought were your friends your private email information. This was not, in fact, true, but the appearance drove people crazy. Now, we fixed it in 4 calendar days, but it was an example of a launch error, and it was difficult to recover from that. But I think it's an example of a good reminder to us of how sensitive people are to the questions that you're asking. And I think we've learned from it.
Newspapers. How's your relationship with the Murdochs at the moment?
It's very good, actually. We're all very good friends.
They haven't.
Oh, and I'm very good friends with Steve Jobs, I should say, as well. I know it's a shock.
But Murdoch called you a thief and a parasite. That's quite rude. Has he apologized for that?
I did not ask for an apology, nor would I expect one.
Do you think you're a thief and a parasite?
Well, now that's a direct question, and the answer to that question is no. Another question.
There was a piece, we were just discussing the piece in The Atlantic by James Fallows, which seemed to suggest that there was real serious effort inside Google to engage with this issue of the future
of
newspaper. Is that genuine, or is that just because you feel it's bad publicity and you want to put out an olive branch?
Hopefully Google does not do things about because of publicity at all. That would be sort of a violation. We view ourselves as innovators, and we try new things, and we're not perfect, and we make mistakes. But hopefully the things that you hear about are sincere efforts to do something new. In the case of news, here's the argument I would make. And again, we'll use the iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and future tablets from other manufacturers and so forth as a metaphor. Think internet first. What does the news reading experience look like some number of years from now? Well, it's clearly going to be on one of these digital devices because you carry it everywhere. It will have color. It will have lots of information. It will have text, of course. It will have video. It will have the ability to go very deeply. It'll know what you read, and so it'll show you what's changed as opposed to repeating things over and over again. The newspaper often tells me things I already know because I already read it and they forgot I knew it, but it's a static, not dynamic. It'll have very, very sophisticated advertising products that are much more multimedia-centric. Think of the current print ads on newspapers can be replaced by multimedia display ads that are likely to be quite lucrative. But the most important thing is that it'll be highly personal and that the newspaper will be much more of a personal construction. And I was trying to comment earlier that there's some danger that personal construction will narrow the field of view, and the serendipity principle of newspapers is very important. So we'll find some balance in that. So if you follow that line of reasoning, then Google wants to be the company that offers the pieces that I just described to content publications like yourself to do with as you see fit. So the article that you're referring to, Jim's article, basically talked about not only the development of the kind of user interface that I'm talking about, but also monetization, both in terms of advertising formats and subscription formats. The Murdoch comment was really about what are known in the industry as paywalls. And there's a dispute within the industry as whether ultimately news will be charged for through a subscription mechanism or through advertising. My view is we want to enable both, and we'll let the consumers and the businesses that properly own the content make that decision.
China. What's going on? Have you heard from the government?
Yes. We talked to them a great
deal.
The history was that we decided that we did not, the laws require active censorship. We decided to move to Hong Kong, former British protectorate. Thank you very much. And the pitch in China is one country, two systems. We like the other system better. So we moved ourselves to Hong Kong, and the way the censorship works is the Chinese government has what is known as the Great Firewall of China, which sits there, and you're not allowed to talk about it very much, but basically content goes through it, and then some content doesn't make it to the other side, and that's how the censorship is done. So we made this decision pretty much unilaterally based on the things that happened to us to great fanfare, and that's been in place now for a few months. As part of our operations in mainland China, we needed a license called an ICP license in order to run our businesses there. And the Chinese government said, look, you have to make a few more changes. You have to get rid of what is called the redirect. And we didn't exactly have a lot of choice. So we made that change, and that change was done earlier this week. I want to be clear that the Chinese government has the arbitrary ability to shut Google down in China, mainland China, if they should choose to. So far, they have not done so, and we would hope that they would not.
Some people think the redirect is going to be an end to Google in China, and some people believe it's an expedient, commercially expedient move on your behalf.
Oh, I can assure you it's not. No coherent commercial business would have made the decisions we made about China, trust me. This was not a business decision. This was a principal decision because it puts revenue at risk and those kinds of things. But Google is a different kind of company. We made a decision based on our values and our principles. I'm sure the decisions are surely negative for the standpoint compared to the alternative amount of revenue, but we don't run the company that way. So the answer is I don't know, but I do want to make sure. I think that people who speculate what's going to happen in China don't understand how China works.
Some questions from Twitter, because I announced I was going to be talking to you today. This is from Adam Banks. Apple wins by making its products more beautiful as well as more functional. Why are Google's relentlessly ugly?
I really like this new crowdsourcing of questions, because you can ask the most obnoxious questions in someone else's name,
I've got lots
right?
More, don't worry.
Are there more coming,
yeah.
Right? And I would say, by the way, that is an excellent question. A simple answer about Apple, and I speak as a proud former board member of Apple. so that's clear, is that Apple is a particular model of a closed ecosystem, and they do a particularly good job. So as long as you're willing to use their platforms, their language, their development tools, their ad monetization, and all of their service, and get everything approved by them, you have a great outcome. And it works. So I'm saying that with respect. Now, there is an alternative model, and it's the model that Google was built up in, which is an open and choice model. And that one roughly goes the same way. We'll end up with very high-quality products, but we'll do it in a way where we don't restrict choices. So you can use any development platform, you can use any operating system, you can cross-connect in any particular way, there's no approval process for applications, you can use any development environment, you can use any ad monetization system, and so forth and so on. And we're going to use web standards. Now, why would we choose one versus the other? Well, we were built in the open way, because the web is fundamentally open. It's about possibilities.
You can probably give one-word answers to these. This is from Riptari.
It's Twitter, so you have 140-character answers. I apologize if my answer was so long. I haven't quite learned how to speak in 140 characters yet.
Yeah, but you can probably, there's four one-word answers to four questions. What happened to Google Wave? You can do a sentence if you want.
Okay. So Google Wave is still in development and still in use.
How many active users does Buzz have?
We don't disclose the number of active users. It is in the many millions, and it's growing quite quickly.
Has Chrome OS been delayed?
No.
Is Google Me true or false?
That would be pre-announcing a possible future product, which I would not do on a Twitter or off a Twitter account.
Sounds like yes.
That was your tweet
was
in
my
response.
Tweet.
You can't retweet my answer. You have to have your own answer, right?
Chris Diamond, when is Google Voice coming to the UK, please?
I thought it was it's on its way.
Okay. Yeah. There's one final question from Twitter, and then if somebody can put their hands up to catch the eye of somebody with a microphone. The final question from Twitter from Rob Taylor, who describes himself as a self-facilitating media muppet.
Self-facilitating media muppet. Okay.
As a billionaire, do you fancy buying Wrexham Football Club and donating it to the local community?
The answer would be no.
No, right.
Thanks. Hi, Eric. Robin Blandford from Ireland. I want to know, what do you work on, or what would you work on in your 20% time?
In my personal 20% time?
Yeah.
I'm very interested in the sort of statecraft and foreign policy issues and the implication on technology. My sort of personal view is that governments are going to... as an observation, we're talking mostly about society and corporations, but the most conservative organizations are the bureaucracies of monopoly governments, which is what we have. And they operate based on history and tradition and so forth, and they change very slowly. And my personal view is that technology is about to upend the way governments and statecraft work. So I like to think a lot about how would you organize a government if you took an internet-first way. By the way, I'm not talking about, you know, the driver's services or things like that, which are obvious to be web. I'm thinking more about how would you deal with what people are doing as opposed to what they're saying they're doing. Where do you go with respect to monitoring versus self-expression, the issues of censorship, and so forth. My favorite example is that if you look at Iraq, I went to Baghdad, which is sort of a bizarre place, and you look at the $1 trillion that America spent to, you know, basically invade and occupy Iraq, and you imagine that if we had invaded and occupied Iraq and then built a fiber optic system, put in towers, and put in a surveillance structure that would allow you to see when the IEDs were put, you could have saved some number of hundreds of billions of dollars plus uncountless, you know, human lives by simply using more modern technology than the traditional invasion technology. So I'm very, very interested in trying to figure out how will technology change the process of statecraft in a broader sense of how governments militarily, operationally, and culturally operate.
I was going to call time, but I can catch the business editor of The Guardian with his hand up, so okay, that would be rude not to to ignore him. So, Dan, you've got the last question.
The life cycle of technology companies seems to get shorter and shorter. Something one day will kill Google or replace it or overtake you. What will that be? Or to put it another way, what's your biggest fear? What keeps you awake at night as your threat?
Having studied this for a long time, almost all of the deaths in IT are self-inflicted. Large successful companies, they make mistakes because they don't continue to innovate. They get sloppy, they get slow, they start to believe their own press, you know, what have you. So an example would be nowness. Okay, well, that's a new concept for Google because, you know, 5 years ago, you didn't need to worry about now. We were just busy doing search engine stuff. So we now added real-time information and that kind of stuff. So my fundamental fear about Google is that we have the same fate as other companies, which is that we lose that edge. There are successful models of companies that have been able to maintain that, but they're relatively rare. And so in that scenario, if we lost that edge, we would eventually be a highly profitable but not very relevant company and eventually be bought, which would be sort of a bad thing, although a long, long time from now. So the external threats are likely to occur from truly innovative companies, typically small ones, that manage to see something that we don't see, you know, and then build a big enough business that we can't catch up. And that's the nature of our competition. I don't think that's any different from any other industry. The difference in IT is it happens so fast. The birth-death cycles are so quickly because of the scale of the Internet. And I think that's permanent. In other words, it's you know, the next great success will be an even faster success than Google. The one after that will be even faster than Google, just because of the scale of the Internet and the reach of the things that I talked about.
I'm here at the Activate 2010 Summit with Beth Novick, who is the Chief Technology Officer in the U.S. government, and also here with Martha Lane Fox, who is the champion, the digital champion of the U.K. government in the Cabinet Office. So two very powerful women in technology roles in government. It's first of all, I'm keen to understand, Martha, why do you think that there are women like yourselves who are so powerful in this position, which has traditionally been dominated by men?
I really feel the least qualified person to answer that question, probably. I think that, just speaking from my own story, that there are a lot of men who still focus on pipes, and I guess I've been asked to focus on people, really. And perhaps that's why a woman is traditionally got maybe a bit more affinity and experience with the people side of all of this tech stuff as opposed to just the infrastructure piece.
One of the areas that you spoke about during your talk this afternoon, Martha, was that you wanted to get, you were hoping to get 100% people of the UK's people to engage with the internet at some point, to be connected. Can you talk a little bit about how you intend to do that? Because that's ultimately a very similar aim to what Beth is talking about, i.e. connecting people with power, with government.
Here in the UK, I still think one of the most fundamental reasons is just lack of inspiration or motivation for people who are not currently online. I don't think they understand the benefits, and I don't think they see what's in it for them, so therefore they get into a position of, I'm frightened, I don't want to, I don't need it. And to me, sitting down one-on-one, going through the things that people love and showing them they can do it online is the very first starting block. So we're trying to pull together industry partners that will commit to helping get people online, either by making sure they're marketing the benefits as opposed to marketing the packages of broadband connectivity. We're trying to bring together charitable organizations who are working with the end users who may not be online and encourage them to use technology. And finally, with government, to make them exemplars in all of this. You know, government websites are still too hard. There are still too many of them. And we believe that by focusing on the people who are not online and designing services for them and thinking about the services they're very heavy users of, that actually you can bring a lot more people onto the web.
One of the ways that the UK government has been attempting to engage with this is by opening up its data, using websites like data.gov.uk. And Beth, you're very closely involved in the open data movement in the US. Can you talk a little bit about data.gov?
Data sets by itself are not that interesting. What's exciting is the ability for people to connect around information and to do things with that information, whether it's to inform their participation in a policy-making process, whether it's their ability to, let's say, make a game or a tool that uses nutrition data to create a game for healthy eating. So the data transparency strategy is married with an equal, co-equal strategy around participation. Unless you think those data sets are so dusty, there are 272,000 data sets up on data.gov, and now I think it's about 97.6 million people who have actually been to data.gov to look at data. So people are actually engaging with this information.
Your rather optimistic hope to get 100% of
optimistic
of the UK's
I'll be satisfied with 99%.
Why do we need 100%
participation in the digital sphere?
Because everywhere we're turning, we are asking for people to be participating online. You know, government is publishing data. Industry is using online to provide different services. It is, you know, fact, if you're online, you are more likely to get a job, and when you're in that job, you'll earn more money. It's a fact that if kids have access to technology when they're at school, they will get 2 grades higher than if they don't have access to technology. You will save money if you're online. You will be able to combat your feelings of isolation and loneliness if you're a vulnerable person. You know, on a social and moral case, there is just no question that we need to strive to have everybody involved in technology. There is then the brutal reality of the economic climate that we're living in. You know, the government has got to transform itself, and it will only do that if it takes digitization extremely seriously. You know, opening up data is one stream of that, but radically redesigning public services is another. Keeping this false choice about using paper to talk to people or using the telephone is, to me, just not going to be an option in the future, and we cannot afford to do any of these things without making sure that we have near as damaged 100% connectivity.
Your hope is to engage people by identifying something that they're passionate about, yeah, and then saying, well, this is where you can find it online. Now, Beth, the US has quite a large digital divide. It's an enormous country, and as far as I'm aware, not every area is even connected to broadband as here. Can you talk a little bit about how your role is in encouraging people to come online?
As part of the stimulus package last year, the Obama administration has given out $7.2 billion in broadband grants to ensure more deeper and broader broadband penetration so that we're getting people online faster. But I think we have to also keep in mind that this broadband penetration includes not only web usage and sort of personal computer usage using the traditional web. I say traditional, it's funny, it's 15 years of web usage, but also mobile phone platforms. And so very much what we're doing in trying to rethink democratic institutions and the way government works is to help appeal again to, as Martha said, to people's passions.
It's exciting in both countries that that there has been such an emphasis, particularly in the last 5 years, in the digital space, to the extent that in the US there is now a chief technology officer, and of course in the UK we have a digital champion who's in the cabinet office. What kinds of diplomacy are the two of you working together?
We are.
This is the first bilateral, is that the official term for this? But I'm looking forward to many extended invitation. I don't yet have my cabinet office pass, but when I do, I will happily swipe Beth through to come and visit.
We're going to have a bilateral lunch, I think, momentarily. But we've been here a little bit longer than this government. So we have been in conversation with folks in the cabinet office at number 10. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, data.gov and data.gov.uk provide, I think, a healthy competition for one another, a race to the top in an effort to see who can outdo each other at putting more data sets up online.
I was amused actually to see that up on the Twitter feed while you were talking, Beth, somebody said that that open data is now the latest space race. So we shall see.
Well, it's not just open data, but you know, my personal space race is to make sure that we have 99% penetration of internet usage, and I raise that challenge to you, Beth. Take that back to the US. I'm racing to 99%.
The gauntlet has been thrown down, and I would agree that it's not just about data, because it really is about people, and it's about people engaging with data to take action and solve problems. So I think coming back to your earlier question, you know, maybe it's the women who are most focused on the people, but I think it's also the women who are most capable of doing the million and one things in a day that we need to do to be digital champions in our government and in our society.
If the intention of the UK's digital champion and the US's deputy CTO for open government is to encourage participation, then the way that they propose to do it is to make government data available and relevant. One of the initiatives ongoing in this country has been spearheaded by data campaigner Nigel Shadbolt from Southampton University. Following his successes opening central government data, Charles Arthur spoke with him on the challenges of opening up local government data.
Well, first of all, I think the important thing to say is that the local data is what matters very often to people, because information about your locale, about the crime rates on your street or the local school catchment areas or the local bus timetables, whatever that should be, much of that is held in local authorities or public bodies at the local level. And we don't actually know what's there. It's hard to have, at least with the major departments of state, you've got some hope of going around having ministers say, bring out your data. You've got over 300, 400 local authorities or the public bodies, and it's a very, very large space. Now, there is a commitment with this government to kind of push for that data to become more visible. So there's a commitment as of January that all spending over £500 in local government should be made transparently available. So I think they're going to have to start thinking about how they do that, what standards to use. But in the general case, I think the challenge is to get them to understand, as we've begun to with central government, why this matters, what the advantages are, and how to go about it.
Isn't there a difficulty that they'd be trying to do this at the same time as they're trying to implement spending cuts, that it becomes something of, well, we'll have to push that down the priorities because it's expensive to do?
We actually believe there could be quite significant opportunities via standardisation, via some common publishing models, to make the system more efficient, to take costs out.
And isn't there a problem perhaps with a sort of a data iceberg that we see, that data gets put out there and we say, that's fantastic, we know now where crimes happen, we've got a crime map, but actually we don't see all the things that don't get reported. We sort of don't know what we're missing. We don't quite see the error bars in all the data that's supplied to us.
No, and I think there's in general an issue. If we move the UK, if we move countries increasingly to an assumption of open government data, then we're going to have to bring along with it, I think, this interesting notion of data literacy, so that people can actually ask questions about the quality of the information, the error, but, you know, the certainties around it, how it's being gathered. And I think there's a really quite interesting question that relates to how we educate our citizenry and our younger generation to think about these issues. I think, just by the way, open data represents a really great educational resource to ask some of these questions. The other question is, what's out there at all? We keep coming back to this. We don't have an inventory of the information that's held and collected. There is no requirement within local government to keep such asset registers. And so we couldn't tell you today where we might be, even in 6 months' time, in terms of the amount of information we've got we could get, unless we start thinking about putting that requirement in place. But, you know, to your point earlier, there is a general issue around we're living in a situation where people are going to be asked to do more for less, produce better products for less. I think that's a legitimate challenge, though, and I think actually publishing data is one way you could do that.
That's all for this week. Thanks very much to Charles Arthur. And next week, we're back in the studio. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.